episodes over on iTunes. Just search for us at Dog Works Radio. You can also find us over on social media as well. And calling in from California is Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great here, Robert. It's going to be warming up on the Iditarod Trail, and it's been very, very nice and toasty down here. Got up into the low 80s for the first time in weeks and weeks and weeks. And I know that that sounds insanely warm compared to how things are, you know, up on the Iditarod Trail, where it's been way, way below zero. But, the weather is the weather, so you can't complain too much about it.
Can you imagine that it is a 130-degree difference on the Iditarod Trail compared to where you were sitting this afternoon?
Yeah, it's insane to think about it, and it's not, you know, it's a few thousand miles, but it's not that far away.
Right.
But here we are.
We are in the same country. A lot of folks think we're not, especially UPS and FedEx. They think that we're our own separate country up here. But yes, we are in the United States up here in Alaska, just in case you did not remember from high school geography. Today, it is day two and a half, I guess we could call it, of the 2017 Iditarod. We're continuing our daily coverage. We are here live tonight on our radio station here at KVRF. Alex, what has happened on the trail? I have been busy all day and hadn't had a chance to check things out yet.
Well, you know, it continues to be a very, very fast race. And we are continuing to see the front runners just going and going and going without stopping. I was looking at the tracker just before we got on the air, and it looks like Wade Mars, Dallas Seavey, Mitch, Nick Pettit, Michelle Phillips, and Ali Zirkel are all within about 25 miles and all look like they are making that long run between Tanana and Ruby. So we are, you know, we're a little bit under 2.5 days into the race, and we're already seeing the front runner is almost 350 miles in at this point.
That is cruising down the trail for sure. If you were to do that in a mid-distance race, now remember there are mandatory stops at those, but if you were to have that kind of pace at some of these bigger mid-distance races, you would definitely be breaking records, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting because of the rerouting of the race, the teams get to the Yukon River sooner. And so we've had something that I imagine it probably happened in 2015. I wasn't that aware of it, but we're having a lot of teams are taking their 8-hour mandatory Yukon River rest before they're taking their 24-hour rest. And normally when we're coming up from Willow, teams would be taking their rests, you know, around McGrath or Takotna. So they would be, you know, they would have gotten the 24 under their belt long before they got to the Yukon. But because of the start in Fairbanks and the rerouting, we're getting to the Yukon faster. So we have about a dozen teams that had already taken their mandatory eights before they took their 24s.
Yeah, and, you know, my first story of the day, we definitely have to talk about my man, Nick Pettit. As I mentioned to you on Twitter earlier this afternoon, I said, should I jump on a plane and fly to Vegas and double down on that bet? Or what are you thinking? He is rocking and rolling. He was the first of the Yukon. He received the first to the Yukon award. Tell us a little bit about that fancy meal he got last night.
Yeah, so this is an award that has been sponsored for a long time by the Lakefront Hotel, which used to be the Millennium
Yes.
Hotel, which is also the race headquarters in Anchorage on Spinard. And it is a 5-course gourmet meal, and they fly the chef of the very nice fancy restaurant there out onto the trail. And they make this 5-course meal on a cook stove. So this year, the meal included pear and gorgonzola salad, crab, shrimp, and clams, smoked duck, lamb chops, mango sorbet, Dom Perignon, and a cash prize of $3,500. In addition to that, the village of Tanana gave Nick some handcrafted native crafts done by locals. And then later on, he and a guest can repeat this meal at the lakefront when there's a little bit more time for him to relax after the race. One thing that I did not know, which I learned this afternoon, is apparently this meal is a meal for two. And so Nick Pettit, after he had taken care of his dogs, Martin Boozer came in, the second person into Tanana, about a half hour later, and he offered to have Martin sit down and share the meal with him, and Martin was too tired and refused. So he offered it to a village elder. So if you see, there are a lot of pictures that were on social media and in the news today of Nick Pettit clinking champagne glasses with a native elder woman, and which is a wonderful way to, you know, to both enjoy the meal and to give back to the village and have them, you know, have one of their members be able to share this amazing gourmet meal.
You know, what I found very interesting, and I know it only because I'm a musher, he said up since Sunday he hadn't eaten anything except donuts, a Subway sandwich, and a heck of a lot of Almond Joys on the trail until he reached that meal. And that's musher cuisine out on the race trail, are things like that. You know, some of my favorites are Snicker bars, beef jerky, and hard candy, just to keep something in my mouth so I can keep focused a little bit. But yeah, he is partial to Almond Joys. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, I think what all of those things have in common is that they're very small, and so you can have just a little bit of that. You can have an Almond Joy, you can have a donut or whatever, easy to transport.
Right.
So, you know, I would think that as a musher, you'd be wanting things that you could pack easily, and that once you got them, you could just consume them without having to go into a lot of preparation.
A little bit of a musher secret in terms of trail food. One of my favorites, and a lot of favorites for many mushers, is candied bacon. It is one of the most marvelous things in the world when it's 20 below zero and you're in the middle of nowhere. Brown sugared, candy-coated bacon is the bomb, as they say.
That sounds simultaneously amazing and a little disturbing.
Very good. So let's jump into it real quick, Alex. The top 10 as we speak right now, and I'm sure it changes by the minute, but we're going with Wade Mars, Dallas Seavey, Pete Kaiser, Mitch Seavey, Nick Pettit, Yor Olsom, Michelle Phillips, Ali Zirkel, John Baker, and Noah Burmeister. How are other things happening on the trail? I know I read an article right before air about the rhythm of the middle of the pack. I thought that was a real interesting article written by Joe Runyon. Did you get a chance to read that one?
I didn't, but I've read a bunch of Joe's commentary about the race, both this year and in past years, and always very much enjoy his perspective, and he seems to have a lot of insights.
Yes,
so
he does.
What was he saying about the middle of the pack?
Well, it was interesting because he said that the front runners and the dogs in particular, they'll often not even raise a head unless the dogs are coming and going in terms of the disturbing of the dogs. They'll just, you know, do their business and the dogs rest comfortably. But the middle of the packers, they're out on a, quote, grand adventure out there, and they're constantly fiddling around and constantly barking and howling and fussing around and playing with their partners there. And it's just a much different vibe than it is for those very hardcore teams at the front who, you know, it's all business. Whereas as you work your way to the middle of the pack, it does become that grand adventure. It becomes, you know, more time out on the trail. You're enjoying the company around you. You're typically mushing with your friends. I know at the middle of the pack right now, as typical, the Barrington twins are mushing right together, and a lot of other friends are right there with each other, aren't they?
Yeah, and, you know, this seems like a good time for me to repeat what has become my mantra in our coverage of the race these past few. Actually, many, many different races going on at the same time.
Right.
There's the race at the front and the, you know, the probably 12 to 20 teams that come through and win. Then there are, you know, the solid middle of the pack mushers who are there every year, who move up a little, move down a little, but are there because they just absolutely love it, and they, you know, they have great dog teams, and maybe some of them are 3 or 4 years away from having the right kind of dog line that they could, you know, put together a team that would break the top 20 or break the top 10. But most of them are pretty much going to stay in the middle. So there are those people, and that's always an interesting race too. And then there are the people who are a lot of rookies, a lot of people who have been, you know, planning and saving up and have on their bucket list that they're going to run Iditarod. And those people in kind of the last third of the race, a lot of them have specific reasons why they're running the race. A lot of people will run the race to publicize a certain cause or in honor of a relative or someone that they greatly admired. And those people know that they're never going to win, and they know that they're not really competitive in the way that the people in the middle or certainly the people in the front are. And yet, for a lot of them, they're able to relax a little bit more. You know, there are still an enormous number of challenges that they have to face on a daily basis, but it's a different kind of race if you go into it thinking it's going to take you 2 weeks as opposed to going into it thinking this is going to be an 8 or 9 day race.
You know, I totally agree. And you talked about some of those folks that aren't quite there yet. And I'm looking right now at Sebastian Verdnard is how I believe you pronounce it. He is from France. He is the rookie that is leading the other rookies currently. He's in 15th place on his way from Ruby from Tananaw. And I read a story about him this morning, or it could have been earlier this afternoon, right before air. He started the race with 12 dogs. The lowest amount that you can start the race with is 12, and you have to finish with 5. Remember, most teams start with 16. And he said that he didn't have any more other dogs to bring with him from France, and he has some puppies waiting for him when he gets home, but he brought all that he had. Did you read that story?
I did, and you know, that's really a very interesting story. We've seen in the past only a very few people will start with, you know, sometimes every year you'll see a few teams that will start with 15 dogs, sometimes 14 dogs. I believe Zoya Denur a few years back started with 12. But it's very, very rare for someone to have less than 14 dogs when they start. It's an admirable thing that he didn't just scramble to borrow or get another 4 dogs just to have the full complement of 16. I think it really indicates that he has faith in his dogs and he has faith in them as a unit. Given the rerouting of the race this year and not going through the steps and the gorge, if he had done that, it might have been might have been something that would be very difficult and might come to bite him in the end. But hopefully this year, you know, with the route that we're going this year, he'll be fine with 12. He certainly is doing very, very well so far in the race.
He had said that he wants to at least get all 12 dogs to the halfway point. Do you know where the halfway point is here on this year's trail? I assume it's someplace there on the Yukon. But, you know, that has to be a very conservative race plan to make sure that a lot of dogs don't stop dropping out real quick, because you do have to finish with 8. And even with half the race to go, there's still at least 300 miles on the other side there. The last third of the race, as we call it, can be very difficult if you have a small team that may not be ready for those type of conditions.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, this year, because of the rerouting, we have a very, very long distance between the checkpoints. Between Tanana and Ruby is 119 miles, which is extremely long in Iditarod terms. In the Yukon Quest, frequently there will be some checkpoints that are 100 miles or you know, even longer apart. But that's a very long distance for Iditarod. And as a result, you know, in certain ways, it gets a little bit closer to what the old-style Iditarod was, where, you know, there's a lot more camping out, because really, if you're going to be going that long, chances are you're going to need to have a pretty significant stop at some point in those 119 miles.
Yeah, as we mentioned, I believe it was yesterday. Typically, a run is 35 to 40 miles, so they will camp 3 or 4 times on that 119 mile trek. We're talking about the middle to the back of the packers will do that. You know, those top teams can do that in a couple of runs. We also mentioned that 10 runs in 100-mile type deal that we may be looking forward to. But, yeah, there's going to be a lot more camping on this year's Iditarod than past, and in particular in between these two checkpoints, as you mentioned, because there's just not that support as there is on the traditional north and south route that we typically see on Iditarod.
Yeah, and I'm trying to look at where exactly the halfway point is this year, and I believe it is either Hooslea or Koyukuk.
Okay. All right. Alex, we are only about 11 minutes in. Remember, we're a live show tonight, so we cannot go a second over, and I want to make sure that we talk about our featured musher today. His name is Dr. Joe Carson. We are keeping with the old guy theme on this year's episode. So what do you have to say about Joe?
So Joe Carson is a very interesting guy. He, for many years, was one of the volunteers in the McGrath checkpoint. He will tell you, and in fact, there's a couple of videos of him on Iditarod.com, and he mentions this in all the videos I've seen of him. He will tell you that he's a fourth-generation Alaskan. This is a guy, he is a Iditarod rookie, 60 years old, but he's found dogs and mushing all of his life. He's run races like the Bear Grease, the John Bear Grease, the Yukon Quest 300, and a bunch of mid-distance races. He runs a company that makes pet food supplements, so makes natural supplements for dogs, cats, birds, honeybees, all sorts of animals. And he said that one of the reasons why he wanted to run Iditarod was to have a chance to really see how these supplements that his company makes are used and work out on the trail. He's running a team of dogs from the Snowhook Kennels, Justin Savitas' kennel. And what I think one of the more interesting things about Joe Carson is his grandfather was a trailbreaker for the first Iditarod in 1973.
Wow.
And later was given a Founders Award. And he talks about how his grandfather and Joe Reddington would sit around in bars and talk about planning the Iditarod and planning how this race was going to proceed. And he was one of the his grandfather was one of the people who went out and actually put the trail in for that first race in 1973. He has 13 grandchildren, and he's said that one of the reasons why he wants to run Iditarod is to show that even though he's 60 years old, that he has a lot of life in him, that people who are in their 60s and 70s are not ready to give up, that that there's still a lot of living you can do and still a lot of amazing things that you can accomplish. He for many years was a pastor and was originally got to McGrath through pastoring. That's not really a word. Through the ministry. He talks a lot about how the Iditarod brings a sense of history and a sense of old-time Alaskan values. And especially some of the villages are really, really struggling, and to have the Iditarod come through. And we talked last year quite a lot about how there are, you know, certainly some problems sometimes with this big race coming through and then abandoning the villages, but having the race come through these villages really brings in a lot of people, brings in a lot of economic life that might not otherwise be there, and helps both people who are outside the villages and the villagers reconnect with what their history is in terms of dog mushing and in terms of the history of dogs in Alaska. He said that he learned how to run dogs from his uncle, who would run dogs up and down trap lines with the Mackey family back in the old days. And his great-grandfather, he talks about how his great-grandfather arrived in Alaska with literally 5 cents to his name.
Oh, my goodness.
And worked for the first 2 years just for room and board, and then was able to start making more of a living and go out homesteading. And, you know, really that there's both a very, very strong work ethic and a very strong sense of the need to appreciate and be invigorated by life rather than just going along with it. And that comes through in every interview I've seen him do. He also is talking about trying to start up again the Mail Trail 202, which was a mid-distance race that was run in the 1980s and that then stopped. So he is one of the people trying to bring that back. Just a really, really great guy, a very nice and friendly man, and it is very exciting that he is finally realizing this dream, and after years of being a volunteer and years of helping out at checkpoints, that he is actually behind the runners and running Iditarod.
And what I would like to add to that, Alex, is I'm looking currently at his speed. He's on the trail from Tanana to Ruby, it looks like. Or is he still? I assume he's still on the trail. And he is going a very respectable 8.25 miles an hour at the last time I refreshed this. That's right up there with the front runners. So he's doing pretty good on the trail. He's currently in 54th place. So he has about 18 or 20 mushers behind him there. And if he can keep up that pace for a good portion of the race, I think he's going to do very well for his first rookie run. And speaking of that, Alex, I really would like to touch on that tomorrow, is the speed of a dog team. You know, I think a lot of folks say, oh, wow, they're blazing down the trail, but really they're only going 8 or 10 miles an hour, which is truly blazing down the trail. But I'm looking right now at a lot of these teams, and they're in the 4.9s, 4.3s, 4.2s, 5.1, 4 miles an hour. Those guys are just barely crawling along. You could walk that fast, couldn't you?
Yeah, and, you know, there's a huge difference between a team that's going 9 or 10 miles per hour and a team that's going 4 miles per hour. It's not just that it takes you longer to go places, although obviously that's part of it, but the dogs are expending a lot of energy, and I'm not sure. You probably know a lot more about this than I do, but I would imagine that they might even be expending more energy if they're going slower than if they were going faster.
Yes, let's definitely cover it tomorrow. I got some cool anecdotes to add to that. I just had a nice discussion with Iditarod Musher about that over our Christmas break, and I think I can add some unique perspective, because most people that watch the race are doing just as you are right now. They're following that blasted tracker on the Iditarod Insider, and they just keep hitting refresh, refresh, refresh. And it looks like their musher that they're following, whoever that may be, is making that ever so gradual trip down the trail, and they truly are going less than 10 miles an hour.
Yeah, and you know, it's something, because now that we have the tracker, and I think back to when I started, and then there was one year where they had a pilot program and they had trackers on I think 8 or 9 sleds, and then the next year it was on all the sleds, and now, you know, it used to be that you would sit there on Iditarod.com and you would hit refresh over and over again on the standings page and wait until somebody came into one of the checkpoints. And that was the only way that you would know what was going on. And then sometimes a team would go into the checkpoint and then leave immediately, and it would appear you weren't sure how far down the trail they had gone, and sometimes they would only go a couple miles down the trail and stop and camp, and it would appear to other people that they might be 40 or 50 miles further along.
Right.
So, you know, it's really changed how we look at the race and how we watch.
Right. Alex, we keep losing you there for just a second or two on your phone. I don't know if something's happening with your cell phone or not, but I think we'll get it cleared up here. So, Alex, we have just a minute or so left. Anything you want to mention in closing?
The one thing I wanted to say is there are great pictures that are up on the Iditarod Facebook page, as well as in a lot of the news coverage of the checkpoint in Tanana, and there's a sign that says, "Iditarod Mushers, we knew you'd be back, 2003, 2015, 2017.
Excellent, for sure. Have we had any scratches yet, other than that first one there on the first day?
We haven't, and it's a little bit unusual to go this far in without any scratches at all. So, it's a combination of a good trail and people being prepared and the dogs doing very well.
I think it's going to be a nice race. I only have a couple of more days with you, Alex, and then we're going to turn it over to Michelle as I hit the expedition with the UAA students. I look forward to being on with you tomorrow night and Friday, and then it's up to you guys to handle it for the rest of the show.
All right. Thanks very much, Robert.
Thank
you. I'll talk to you tomorrow.
No problem. On behalf of my co-host, Alex Stein, this is Robert Forto. We will talk to you guys next time. Goodbye.